Good evening. I'd like to welcome you all to our second session, I guess, of our 2006 IBRI colloquia. Tonight we're looking at a topic which you've got papers for, The Stones Cry Out, How Early Christian Geologists Enlarged Their Understanding of the Creation Account. You have an abstract on your paper, but since I'm recording this, I probably better read this abstract, which is slightly shorter, into it. The development of modern geology in the late early 1800s challenged traditional biblical interpretation in a way that no other advance in science had. Never before had such an extensive, sustained, and comprehensive assault on tradition been fortified with such an abundance of irrefutable factual data. How then did devout Christians process this challenge? This talk describes the responses of a number of contemporary writers who held firmly to the divine inspiration of biblical text, including prominent British and American geologists and theologians of the period. Our lecturer tonight is Dr. David C. Bossard, has a doctorate from Dartmouth in mathematics, did his undergraduate and master's level work in physics, has been a systems analyst. Does that sound right?
Yeah.
All right. On lots of different government projects for many, many years, and has fairly recently retired, been up in New Hampshire, and Lord willing is coming down here into the Harleysville area, this area. So welcome, David Bossard.
Thank you, Bob. What I'm going to talk about tonight is what the geologists said in the vicinity of 1800, 1850, 1860. So the way I'm presenting it is what they said. So if you have arguments, you argue with them. Okay. Obviously, I'm sympathetic to a lot of the things they say, but that's the purpose of this thing. It's not for me to analyze what they said, but just to say what they said. The talk that you have in your hands, if you look at the bibliography, that's about halfway through the pages you have. Again, they're almost exclusively things that were produced prior to 1860, maybe a couple later than that. They're not modern commentaries on geology in the 1800s. They're what the geologists said in the 1800s. Many of those books are on the web, on my website, and so you can check me out. You can extend what I say by other things they say, etc., etc. There's a lot of footnotes in the talk. Obviously, given the talk, there's lots of things I don't say that are in the footnotes. I tried in the footnotes to kind of expand on some of the specific things I mentioned and give some quotes and so forth and so on. But when you get, if you're interested, you might want to, well, my wife read it through once without reading the footnotes, and she read it through a second time reading the footnotes, and she figured she finally maybe understood something. Okay. Why, these are quotes from the period by geologists. Why should the enlightened Christian, who has a correct idea of the firm foundation on which the Bible rests, fear that any disclosures of the arcana of nature should shake its authority or weaken its influence? Is not the God of Revelation the God of nature also? That's by Edward Hitchcock, who was an American geologist. His heyday was 1830 to 1860, roughly. John Pye Smith was a theologian who was very interested as an amateur in geology. And his first writing, John Pye Smith's first writings were in the 20s and 30s, 1820s, 1830s. It is a fearful thing to array science and religion against each other. Men who have well studied the question at issue and who know the evidence that of those geological facts to which such strong exception is taken cannot by any possibility be brought to renounce their convictions. And then finally, Hugh Miller, whom I have learned to really appreciate. When I first read Hugh Miller, I thought he was kind of flowery, a little bit wifty-headed. You know, he he tends to, effervesce about, what he's seeing and so forth and so on. But I have come to really appreciate him. I have been described as one of the wretched class of persons who teach that geology, rightly understood, does not conflict with revelation. Incidentally, I am not going to talk about the fundamentalist reaction to these geologists, the reaction of people who didn't know about geology but figured it was a challenge to the Bible. There is one of the references talks about, is a very good review of those people, okay? But it's not my purpose. My purpose is to talk about the geologists themselves. For a number of years, I have indulged a fascination with 19th century science. In fact, I run a website with that name, 19thcenturyscience.org, where I post a number of books from the period. The 19th century was a golden age of science, as viewed from the eye of a practitioner. It was an exciting time to work as a scientist. Empirical science had shaken off the restraints and bad habits of medieval times. Newton's remarkable work and the arrival of the microscope and telescope opened the door to vast new vistas, and things had not yet become too complicated. Until late in the century, it was still possible to have a comprehensive understanding of entire fields of work, such as chemistry, biology, physics, and astronomy. There is nothing so fascinating as being in on the ground floor of a new science. And there were many opportunities for that in the 19th century. When I look back on my career, I feel enormously blessed to have experienced the very beginnings of the computer age. I recall reading an autobiography of Chuck Yeager, the famous test pilot. When asked in the 1980s if he was envious of the new generation of test pilots, he shook his head no. "Test pilots now," he said, "can't fly seat of the pants. Things are too complicated. They are almost totally dependent on engineers for their safety. When he flew by instinct. His instincts were good, and he trusted them. You can't use instinct any longer." I think I know what Chuck Yeager was saying, and I agree. The 19th century was golden because the scientists of the day were close enough to the beginnings that things hadn't yet gotten too complex. It was a marvelous time to exercise true empirical science, a time when skillful practitioners forged the outlines of new sciences based on observations and logical analysis, playing Sherlock Holmes with the observable facts to forge them into daring conclusions that can be tested and challenged. Geology is a science that calls upon all sorts of other disciplines, all branches of chemistry, biology, physics, and astronomy. So as the century proceeded, it got very complex and specialized. But at the beginning, it was not that way. Modern geology began on June 11, 1799, when William Smith wrote down the key to interpreting the rocks based on his own extensive work. The key was the Rosetta Stone that would open up the rock's language. He made four key observations. First, that most of the rock on land is sedimentary rock, laid down in identifiable layers, or strata. Second, that the strata extend over large areas. Third, that the strata are characterized by the type of rock in the fossil species. And fourth, that the strata are laid down in a specific order. I am sure some scientists would howl and protest at the claim that geology began at this specific time. After all, didn't the teachings of great geologists such as Werner and Hutton precede this? But here is the pivotal point. Werner and Hutton proposed theoretical explanations for the Earth's present form. Around 1800, there were two theoretical schools of geology. The Neptunists, or Diluvianists, that is, water was the main engine of change, and the Vulcanists, or Plutonists, that is, fire or heat was the main engine of change on the Earth's surface. There were rational arguments for each position, and thinking men were lined up on each side. But the era introduced by William Smith was qualitatively different. William Smith didn't propose theories. He made claims that could be objectively tested and verified. He showed that the Earth's rocks contain a detailed record of the Earth's past. You could take or leave Werner and Hutton's theories, or balance them against your own favorite theory, but it's hard to dispute the observable facts revealed by William Smith. Of course, there is some level of interpretation to William Smith's findings, and you are certainly welcome to make your own. But the language of the rocks is very factual and concrete. And if you propose an interpretation, there are thousands of ways that your interpretation or William Smith's may be supported or refuted. And, this is the peculiar power of the truly empirical sciences, the same facts that you base your interpretation upon can be verified and multiplied by any competent scientist, regardless of his own views on the matter. And they were. Over the next 40 years, the work of William Smith was duplicated, confirmed, and expanded by hundreds of scientists worldwide in an astonishing explosion of knowledge. What William Smith had found to be true about the geology of the British Isles proved to be true worldwide in a remarkable harmony in the message that the rocks and strata convey. The direct implications of William Smith's geology were seen almost immediately. First, that the Earth is demonstrably old, much more than the 6,000 years or so implied by the common understanding of the Genesis creation account. Second, that the geologic strata emphatically could not be the result of a global deluge, as the common understanding of the Genesis flood account would have it. Over the next few decades, these implications would be fortified with a vast amount of corroborating material to the point that, by the 1840s, no thinking person who had a deep understanding of the facts of geology as they were then known could doubt that the Earth is very old and that the strata cannot have been laid down by a global Noachian flood. A number of devout Christian geologists of the time expressed these conclusions in just this definitive, absolute way. The question is, and this is what we will consider, how do they then maintain their high view of Scripture? This empirical basis for William Smith's geology formed a dilemma for many of the practicing Christians of his day because the findings challenged the common interpretation of the biblical text. The Christians that I'm interested in here are those who had a high view of the inspiration and accuracy of the biblical account, a view that I myself share. These Christians did not believe that the Old Testament accounts were hoary myths or folklore, but that they are accurate written records of the events that they describe. But the geological records seem to contradict many of the assumed interpretations of these accounts, particularly the creation account in Genesis 1-3 and the flood account of Genesis 6-8. What to do? As scientists, they could not disregard the clear evidence of geology, and as devout Christians, they could not deny the foundations of their faith. This is what we will explore today. Now, it should be understood that throughout the Christian era, long before the dawn of the age of science, the creation and flood accounts were singled out as puzzling, and there were many ways that they were understood. For example, St. Augustine, back around 400 AD, devoted a major part of his writing to the meaning and interpretation of the Genesis accounts. He puzzled over statements like, "And the earth was without form and void," and the question of how the days of creation were to be understood. Regarding days, his puzzlement was why God, who is not bound by time, should take any time at all. And his own solution was that the whole creation occurred in an instant. I leave it to your curiosity to puzzle out how he then ended up with 7 days. Over his life, Augustine returned to these issues at least 3 times, the most recent being the literal meaning of Genesis. One of the things Augustine struggled with was whether the Genesis account was to be understood allegorically or literally. In his day, a number of Christian theologians put a lot of effort into reading the Bible allegorically, and Augustine at first was among that number. But later he put aside attempts to see allegorical meaning and concentrated on the literal meaning of the text. I should note, however, that some of his, quote, literal meanings seem to be a bit figurative, but that's another story. Augustine used the term literal to mean a faithful record of what happened, according to the plain meaning of the historical facts. The fact is, what one means by literal in any human language, which is by its very nature consists of figurative and elusive words, is itself a deep question. In the literal meaning of Genesis, Augustine tried to reconcile the then understanding of science with the interpretation of the Genesis account. Despite the primitive and largely fallacious science of his day, he had, in my view, the instincts of a true scientist and a genuine interest in proper scientific inquiry, and as a result, he was very bothered by theologians who would make interpretations that seemed nonsense to scientists. There are a number of famous quotes from him along these lines. Among the rules of interpretation that he held to are these. First, that the Bible was written so as to be understandable by the contemporary hearers at the time it was written. And second, that the viewpoint of the biblical writer is from the perspective of a person standing on earth and not from the perspective of one viewing the earth from the heavens or some other location. For example, in discussing the question, are the sun, moon, and stars of equal brightness, he remarks, they differ in glory to the eyes of men on earth, so that the question of which is greater, or which is lesser, or whether they are equal, is not the point. Augustine himself saw that many of the particular passages in Genesis could be understood in a number of ways, and he was careful to lay out alternative interpretations without endorsing a particular one as the only way to look at, to see it. So at the beginning of the 19th century, Orthodox Christians, at least the educated theologians among them, understood that the Genesis accounts could be seen in a number of ways. Reasonable people could disagree on the particulars, and similarly, reasonable people in the attempt to maintain unity and fellowship could defer to another person's authority in areas of legitimate doubt. But, as Tevye asked in Fiddler on the Roof, how far can you make a man bend over backward before he breaks? Does geology push Christian geologists to the breaking point? These geologists believed not, and that's what we will discuss today. There was a more or less universal set of understandings based, it was thought, on the most direct reading of the biblical text. A summary might be this. First, that the material world had a definite beginning. Matter is not eternal. On this point, geologists generally agreed. A geologic record definitely indicates in the azoic rocks, which underlay all the fossil-bearing strata, that life had a beginning. And knowledge of the figure of the earth, an oblate spheroid, implied that the earth itself was one time a molten mass. In this, the geologists departed from the earlier view of Hutton and Playfair that the geological record had no vestige of a beginning, no prospect of an end. Secondly, the conventional understanding of the Bible, of the creation issue, the primordial world arose out of a state of chaos. That's where the famous phrase, without form and void, comes in. As we noted earlier, this expression from Genesis 1-2 can be interpreted in various ways. Some early 19th century theologians and geologists took it to indicate a gap of indefinite extent between the creation of the heavens and the earth in Genesis 1-1 and the start of the creation week. Later geologists questioned the gap, noting that the geological record has no indication of a catastrophic event, presumably resulting in a state of chaos, in the period just before the modern species of animals, plants, and humans appear. By implication, this would move the period of chaos to an earlier time, perhaps as the earth was formed. A third point of the conventional understanding, the primordial world was covered with water, out of which God gathered dry land. On this, geologists generally agreed. There is abundant geological evidence that the continents were one time underwater. In some cases, as in Europe, the land mass was alternately raised and submerged multiple times. The modern view is that the primordial earth was completely covered with oceans and that the land mass that ultimately formed the continents rose out of the water over a period of more than a billion years, literally floating on a molten mantle of dense basalt rock. The fourth conventional point, creation occurred in a creation week of six literal 24-hour days, with the seventh day, the Sabbath, a day of rest. The early geologists generally held to literal days. It is likely, but not always clear, that they assumed the days were back-to-back. To maintain this position, they held to a primordial gap in which the geological column was laid down and took the creation days to refer to a recreation of life. Later geologists generally abandoned literal days, notably Hugh Miller, who suggested that the days were prophetic, arguing that the language reads like a visual account in much the same way that some prophecies are understood, picking out highlights and passing over other details. In his Testimony of the Rocks, he relates the creation days to geologic ages, as if Moses were looking back over all of Earth history in a prophetic vision and recording creation as visual highlights. Other geologists, however, believe that this correspondence with geologic ages was imperfect at best. The fifth point of the conventional understanding of the Bible. There was no protracted development of plants and animals. Land plants were created on day three. Sea creatures and birds were created on day five. Creatures that move along the ground, unquote, were created along with man on day six. The geological record flatly contradicts this view, the view that humans were created within mere days of the creation of plants and animals, unless one holds the view of some geologists that the creation week refers to a local creation of a human habitat. In this view, the geological record relates to a totally separate, protracted creation of the world's plants and animals that is not mentioned in the Genesis account. The sixth point of conventional understanding of the biblical creation account. The creation account concerns the whole of creation, not just the localized part of it. Well, we've already mentioned that that possibility. The seventh point, the creation account combined with the subsequent history of mankind recorded in Genesis, even allowing for gaps in genealogy, implies that the earth is at most a few tens of thousands of years old. The geological record flatly contradicts this. 8. All plants and animal life were created to reproduce after its kind, the so-called fixity of species. Many early geologists accepted this view, as long as kind was interpreted to mean something more general than specific species and varieties. Adherents would include most geologists through the 1830s, including Charles Lyell, who generally did not make comments in the lines of natural theology. The very real gaps in the fossil record, and particularly gaps in the periods of renewal following catastrophes, for example, between the primary, secondary, and tertiary eras. Incidentally, those terms, if you look in the back page, you'll see a diagram of the various eras and so forth in the animal life. It doesn't discuss plant life, but animal life. Now, that came out of one of the books, I think a Hitchcock book, if I recall. I think it's referenced there. The very real gaps in the fossil record, and particularly gaps in the periods of renewal following catastrophes, were viewed by many geologists as marking new direct creations of God. Among later geologists, there was, however, expressed a kind of adaptation. In fact, Hitchcock and others made the point that the environment determined the kind of animals created in a given era. Several geologists argued against the concept of progressive development was a purely naturalistic thread through the entire creation process. This view was held by Robert Chambers and the biologist Lamarck. After Darwin's publication of The Origin of Species in 1859, the progressive development concept rapidly overwhelmed or ignored the objections of the early geologists, until in the end, even former adherents as Lyell, Dana, and Geike gave it at least lip service. Ninth point about the conventional understanding of the biblical text. Before Adam's fall, there was no death because death was a punishment for Adam's transgression. This is flatly contradicted by all biological and geological evidence. A number of geologists wrote at length about this view. Tenth, the terms all, every, and the whole in the flood account are universal, not just local. Thus, the flood was over the whole earth in the conventional understanding. A number of the natural theology books written by geologists address this issue. The fact is that there are abundant instances in the Bible to illustrate that the cultural use of these seemingly all-inclusive terms often simply signifies a large number, but not literally all. And there are a number of examples of that in the literature. Geology confirms the view that catastrophic floods occurred throughout the geological record, and so the factuality of a massive flood as described by Moses is not in doubt. But the flood must have been local, not universal, and a one-year flood would not be likely to leave identifiable evidence. All geologists confirm that the main geologic strata are not flood deposits. The character of the geological strata, the orderly deposition of fossils, the vast ages over which the strata were formed under conditions of external tranquility are inconsistent with a flood. 11th point, and the last one we're going to mention. The ark rescued all kinds of animals, not just a small selection. By implication, all animals subsequently radiated from Ararat throughout the earth after the flood. Geological and biological evidence show that the species variations worldwide are inconsistent with the view that all animals radiated out from a localized area of the globe since the flood. There just isn't enough time to generate the amount of speciation after the flood. Further, the number of species worldwide is far more than would be accommodated on the ark. If it is assumed that kind represents a significantly higher taxonomic level than species, then the speciation in the time since the flood would not be sufficient to produce the present diversity. Some authors resolve issues with the flood narrative by asserting A, the Noachian flood was a local flood, B, the animals included in the ark were domestic and game animals that were of economic value to humans, and C, that the flood may have been associated with the raising or lowering of the landmass in the Ararat region. It should be noted that the consensus of science before about 1800 did not contradict these points. Just as prior to the time of Copernicus, the scientific consensus did not indicate that the Ptolemaic model of the universe was wrong. It is exceedingly unfair to poke fun at the theologians or scientists of these times for interpreting the Bible in the most direct possible way. After all, that is entirely in the spirit of Occam's razor. Only when the evidence clearly and unequivocally pointed in another direction could it be reasonably hoped for biblical interpretation to change. In 1550, even after Copernicus published the De Revolutionibus, I would probably have sided with the Ptolemaic worldview. For one thing, the Copernican model left a number of important things dangling unresolved. The concept of inertia, for example, had not been either experimentally or theoretically explained. Galileo, whose experiments proved inertia, would not be on the scene for another century. In 1800, at the time that the science of geology began, the objective arguments for an extremely old age for the Earth were still in the future. And again, there was little reason, in my view, to change the traditional interpretation of Scripture. However, factual evidence would pour in at an incredible pace, and overwhelming evidence against this traditional interpretation would be developed. We can summarize the response of geologists to the prevailing biblical interpretation under four headings. And I'll go through these four headings: natural theology in the 19th century, before and after 1859, points of agreement between geology and the prevailing biblical interpretation, points in which the geological record flatly contradicts the traditional view, and reconciliation. If you look at the geology books published in the 1800s, you will notice that in the first half, many of the prominent geologists devoted considerable effort to discussions of natural theology, which included indications of the glory of God displayed in his creation and reconciliation of the natural revelation with the written revelation, or as it was put, the harmony between God's works and God's words. Geologists and theologians who published significant works on natural theology in the early to mid-1800s include, in approximate order, William Paley, Thomas Chalmers, William Conybeare, William Phillips, who was a nephew of William Smith, William Buckland, John Pye Smith, Edward Hitchcock, David King, Hugh Miller, and Louis Agassiz. Others spoke favorably of God's hand in creation, men such as Charles Lyell, Adam Sedgwick, and James Dana. Few prominent scientists openly argued for a fully naturalistic explanation of things, but the notable exception of Robert Chambers, who sided with the biologist Lamarck in arguing in Vestiges for progressive development of species, the basis for Darwin's views. I should note that Robert Chambers published anonymously until after our, his name wasn't associated with his writing, the book Vestiges, for example, until after Darwin's book came out. And in a couple of the references, if you look up some of the references that are on the web, you'll see this anonymous geologist said such and such, or whatever it was. The publication of Darwin's Origin of Species in 1859 marked a significant change. After 1859, the treatment of natural theology by prominent geologists greatly diminishes, and most of what is said is by holdovers from the previous era, such as Louis Agassiz and James Dana. Of course, there was very much written about natural theology by Christian apologists who were opposed to the attempts to harmonize geology, but we will not go into that here. And that footnote gives a place to look it up on the web. It's a very good book. Points of agreement between the geological and the prevailing biblical interpretation. As we already noted, many of the early Christian geologists remarked that there are many points on which the two accounts, the geological and the biblical interpretation, agree. Both state that life on Earth had a beginning. The geological record indicates a blossoming of life on Earth from an initial lifeless condition. Two, both state that dry land emerged from the oceans. Three, in both, plants flourished on land before land animals. Fourth, in both, fishes and birds precede land animals. Fifth, in both, humans appear last of all. Sixth, in both, humans derive from a single Eve, quote unquote. Seven, in both, human civilization radiates from the vicinity of the Near East. Eight, both agree that humans are qualitatively distinct from all other living species. This represents a reasonably universal consensus by mid-century. Things that a geological record does not allow. Despite these points of agreement, there are some matters where the geological record conflicts with the traditional interpretation of the biblical creation account. As noted by some of the authors, all geologists agree on these points. First, the Earth is very old, certainly far older than the few thousands or tens of thousands of years that the traditional interpretation of the biblical creation account allows. Second, death was a universal and essential attribute of life on Earth long before humans were created. There was never a time when death was not the norm. Third, the individual geological strata were generally formed under tranquil conditions over very long periods of time. They are emphatically not the remnants of a Noachian deluge. Fourth, Noah's Ark did not contain all kinds. Fifth, all animals on Earth did not radiate from a single point on Earth following a Noachian deluge. Sixth, plants and animals were not created in the same literal week with humans. Seventh, the consensus after the 1840s, the face of the Earth was not formed primarily as a result of violent revolutions, as Cuvier assumed, but rather it was formed principally under tranquil conditions extending over vast ages of time. Perhaps it's a bit of an exaggeration to say that all geologists agreed on all these points, but certainly there were few holdouts among people who had a thorough understanding of the geological sciences. The basis for reconciliation. It should be emphasized that many of the prominent geologists prior to mid-century were also theologically trained, and so they could make valid comments on theological points of interpretation of the biblical text. First, the Bible does not state that there was no death prior to Adam's transgression, contrary to the traditional view. Buckland, Pye Smith, and others make this argument. Second, universal words, all, every, etc., may have a restricted meaning, not global in the absolute sense, as proved by many clear biblical examples. Third, the word day is not restricted in Scripture to 24-hour days. Fourth, the creation account in Genesis does not require that all the events occurred without gaps or a pause. Fifth, the creation account is not an exhaustive account of the creation of all life. At a minimum, the Genesis account does not discuss the creation of microorganisms for obvious reasons. Reconciliation. Our interest is in the views among Christian geologists who held to a high view of biblical inspiration. These geologists only made changes in their interpretation when they were convinced that the geological data required it. It's clear that their views evolved over time, as shown by their own writings or citations by later writers. It is also clear that they had a certain reluctance to make changes, and so only made them when the need for a viewpoint change became abundantly clear. Edward Hitchcock remarked that it always produces a temporary evil to change the interpretation of a passage in the Bible. The creation account. The geological consensus, an old earth, life existed long ages before Adam's creation, and death was a universal principle of life. The early view, this divides into an earlier view than a later view. Prior to 1840, the earlier geologists generally accepted a revolutions account of the past history of the earth, which meant that the face of the earth is a result of violent catastrophic events. And generally accepted a literal 24-hour creation day. Buckland, one of the early geologists, remarked that the biblical text did not require this interpretation, but it was consistent with the geological evidence as he understood it. And I don't think he lived long enough to, I don't know, I didn't see any writings of him, of his, that were later. And I don't think he survived. I forget exactly when he died, but he basically had that point of view. 24 hours is not required, but it would seem consistent with his understanding of the biblical text. Second, the creation of fossil species occurred before the creation week. Third, they assumed a gap between the creation of the heavens and the earth and the first day. And they identify that gap with the expression without form and void in Genesis 1:2. Fourth, there was a global recreation during creation week, although some authors were not explicit on this global recreation. The later view about creation, after about 1840, later geologists generally accepted a uniformitarian account of the past history of the earth. That was Lyell's primary contribution to geology. He did a long, detailed, careful analysis of the evidence before he came to that conclusion. Some creation days were extended periods of time instead of 24-hour days. That can divide into two positions, that the days were topical or selective days. This reverts to Augustine's own view. And second, the days relate to geologic ages. That was Miller's prophetic days, but the footnote actually says what the correspondence is according to Hugh Miller. This correlation is selective, but not perfect. Some, in the later view, the account is a local creation of Eden, rather than a global earth creation. Third, the account concerns only a small portion of the creation of life. Fourth, they abandoned the later view, generally abandoned the gap theory because they said there's no geological evidence for a recent gap. Okay. Regarding the flood account, the consensus of these geologists was that most geological strata were not formed by a deluge. There's evidence of occasional local deluges throughout geological history. Most plants and animals worldwide are specialized to their own locale with a clear genetic relationship with local fossils. They could not have radiated from a single locale within modern time. The human race is an exception to this rule. A, the Noachian flood was a local deluge. It included the entire human race at that time. Some, it correlated with the rise and fall of the region of Ararat. The second general position, the ark held only some local kinds of plants and animals. Some said it was limited to domestic animals and wild game that were useful for economic purposes. And second, they remarked that the limited time since the Noachian deluge does not allow for much speciation. Hence, the kinds are limited to genus or species, not families or higher. Third, regarding progressive, do we have to stop it now? Okay. Yep. It sounds like you're getting towards the end there. Okay. Third, progressive development or evolution. The views before 1859. Prior to the appearance of Darwin's Origin of Species, most geologists, with the principal exception of Robert Chambers, accepted the following principles. First, all major body plans, the mollusca, the radiata, the articulata, and the vertebrata at the time, appear together in the earliest fossilized strata, the Cambrian era. Second, the fossil record has no classes that are not also found among present-day plants and animals. In other words, no classes, that's a very high level of animal, of kind of animal, no classes went extinct. As in toto. Third, major transitions between strata are characterized by annihilation and sudden appearance of totally different species. Fourth, the fossil record within the stratum indicates that species have a strictly limited range of natural variation regardless of the duration of the age represented by this by that stratum. And some of these strata, incidentally, are thousands of feet thick. I mean, long, long times. Five, plant and animal varieties appear to respond to environmental changes rather than some internal mechanism for change. No, I'm quoting what they say, okay? No major innovations appear within a stratum, but only between strata, separated by major environmental changes. Six, the geologic record shows a regression in complexity from the earlier species rather than a progression as one would expect. I could make some comments about that if we have time to. In his 1860 book, Elementary Geology, Hitchcock specifically excludes natural laws as the engine of speciation. David King, another geologist, more of a popularizer David King talks about the truths in zoology which apparently favor transmutation but which collapse under close scrutiny. After 1859, the old guard geologists, Agassiz, Hitchcock, Bina, continue to hold out, but little is written on natural theology. Such discussions are evidently considered beyond the purview of geological writers. Dana, in the fourth edition of his Geology, in 1894, shortly before his death, included natural evolution in his text, whereas previously, in previous editions, he had held out against. Lydia Miller, the widow of Hugh Miller, remarked as follows on the changes that took place after 1859. And this was a preface to, I believe, the Testimony of the Rocks, which was the edition that was written about 10 years after, about late 1860s. I must confess that I was at first startled and alarmed by rumors of changes and discoveries which, I was told, were to overturn at once the science of geology as hitherto received, and all the evidences which had been drawn from it in favor of revealed religion, though well persuaded that at all times, and by the most unexpected methods, the Most High is able to assert himself, the proneness of man to make use of every unoccupied position in order to maintain his independence of his Maker seemed about to gain new vigor by acquiring a fresh vantage ground. The old cry of the eternity of matter and all things remain as they were from the beginning until now rung in my ears. God with us in the world of science, henceforth to be no more. The very evidences of his being seemed to be removed to a more distant and dimmer region, and a dreary swamp of infidelity spread onwards and backwards throughout the past eternity. This quote, which comes from a preface to Hugh Miller's Sketchbooks of Popular Geology, sets the scene for our discussion. This statement comes about 10 years after the appearance of Darwin's Origin of Species. Already in that short time, the mood of geology had shifted dramatically from a wide consensus that noted strong evidence of God's handiwork in creation to a naturalistic view that saw no need for a God. As Lydia Miller wrote, God with us no more. Lydia Miller expressed the consternation that must have been shared by many of these older geologists had the new changes and discoveries indeed so altered the landscape. What had they missed in their so careful analysis of geological data, done, by the way, amidst hostile opposition from all sides, and thus carefully crafted, or so they thought. In the end, Lydia remarked that, no, they had not missed the mark. The evidence is still the same. It has not changed. It's only being ignored and brushed away. In conclusion, Psalm 19 begins with the words, "The heavens declare the glory of God," and then goes on to use other active words of communication. He proclaims, pour forth speech, displays knowledge, and this is done with a silent voice that goes out, without speech or language, into all the world. What a better example of this can be found than in the language of the rocks, uncovered in the glorious golden days of geology. That silent speech of the stones enriched our understanding of how God created humans, the final goal and the crowning achievement of his creative work. I would love to stop on this note, and yet I am forced to acknowledge that many ignorant but sincere Christians actually see this proclamation as an unwelcome challenge to their concept of God and his inspired word. In the days of the geologists that we have considered here, such Christians opposed their work, even calling it evil. And despite these geologists' marvelous discoveries and clear exposition of their work, that opposition has only grown more strident in the intervening years between then and now. If I did not have total confidence in God's sovereignty, I might despair that his church would be hopelessly damaged by this ignorant opposition to his own declaration of his glory. Certainly in the minds of many outside the church, and in particularly in the minds of the highly educated of this number, the appearance of this opposition cannot work to enhance the cause of Christ. But in fact, this strain of ignorance is nothing new. It has been going on for over 1,500 years. As far back as 400 AD, St. Augustine warned against this kind of ignorance on the part of Christian apologists. Quote, "Now it is a disgraceful and dangerous thing for an infidel to hear a Christian, presumably giving the meaning of Holy Scriptures, talking nonsense on these topics. And we should take all means to prevent such an embarrassing situation in which people show up vast ignorance in a Christian and laugh at the scorn. The shame is not so much that an ignorant individual is derided, but that people outside the household of faith think our sacred writers held such an opinion, and to the great loss of those for whose salvation we toil, the writers of our scripture are criticized and rejected as unlearned men. If they find a Christian mistaken in a field which they themselves know well, and hear him maintaining his foolish opinions about our books, how are they going to believe those books and matters concerning the resurrection of the dead, the hope of eternal life, and the kingdom of heaven, when they think their pages are full of falsehoods on facts which they themselves have learned from experience and the light of reason?" The result can hardly help but fulfill the sad remarks of St. Augustine and cause the gospel message to appear not only morally distasteful, but also scientifically and logically impossible to many sincere, educated, and thinking unbelievers. But for the grace of God, which is abundant and active, the church would surely falter. But it will not fall. God is greater than any opposition to his proclamations, by friend or foe. Glory be to his name, forevermore. Amen. Thank you.